Yeah, what topics do we have?
Here's a good one. This will energize you.
Okay.
It's a tweet from Dan Abramoff. You're writing a library. An evil genius steals...
Are we just getting right into it?
Yeah, we're just going to go. Oh, do you want to tell a story about New York? I like when you open with your New York stories.
What's going on? What's going on in New York?
Well, everyone has COVID.
Yeah. Is this our first podcast from the new year?
Yeah, it is.
It is?
It's like, dude, it's like January 5th.
Oh, yeah. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. I haven't already seen you like 6 days this year.
I know. It's been awesome, actually. We're working out of the new office. And it's fun to be here. So let's get into it. How about that? Because you have a place to be.
Yeah.
We have this topic on our backlog.
So tweet from Dan Abramoff. You're writing a library. An evil genius steals all your library's code somehow. You can't retrieve it and offers you a choice. You can either recover all your library's implementation code or all of your library's tests, but you may not have both. What do you recover?
Well, of course, the question is, how good is the test suite? if the test folder is empty, it's like to do.
If Sam worked on the library, I want neither.
I thought you were going to say test. No, my libraries have good
tests. No, you do. Coverage. You do write good tests.
If the test suite is test to do write test, then obviously I want the implementation.
No, let's say like
given good, that, yeah, assuming there's a good test,
good test and good source code.
Yeah, I think I'd want the tests for a library. I think I remember reading this and I agreed with what he said, which is like if I for Mirage, I can speak from experience there 100%. I'd want to throw away the implementation 100% and keep the test because especially with the ORM, it was tricky figuring out all of those permutations. You know, you have has one that starts null and then you set it. Is it there? You call save on it, all that stuff. So the test coverage, especially around the ORM. Clearly it's 4:15 PM on Thursday, January 6th in New York, which is, the sun is down very early. But yeah, so all of those permutations were tough to figure out. And the implementation is like shit anyways right now. So I don't care about that.
Give yourself enough credit.
But the test suite's there, I'd want. However, for an application.
Well, this is the mind-blowing thing.
Yeah, I think.
Same question.
I think with an app. Because the question was about a library.
Yeah. The original question. And then you answer the question, and then it's literally the exact same question again.
Yeah, with an app.
But instead of library app.
Yeah, I think with an app, they tend to be under. Covered by tests because it's not practical to test all of the things that matter, like the design pixels and some of the transitions, or you know, how often have we written tests for our animations and transitions and application code? You know, not a lot. And so there's a lot of hidden behavior that is actually part of like the contract, I guess. The user of the app is a user, end user, and a lot of the behavior they rely on or expect is not going to be typically present in the test.
Yeah. I mean, also,
so I'd rather have the code for an app. I mean, think about any contract we've come into that's like multiple years old or they're doing a rewrite of it. Like the thing has so much hidden behavior in it, you know, that's not captured by the test suite. Whereas libraries tend to have more robust tests because they're worked on by multiple strangers in open source.
I think even that we should just be charitable and say like in the library example and in the application example, they have good but realistic test suites. Like, you know, it's very easy to say like, yeah, application that's 10 years old has like
bad tests.
You know, 4 tests and only 2 of them pass. But like, no, let's just say it's got like a good test suite, but it's like Cypress tests, which are good, but it doesn't have a test suite that's like opening it on a mobile device
and exactly like
tapping the screen.
Exactly. Which most of them won't have that level.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
I do. I
give me more thoughts.
Yeah. When I was thinking about this, it was like, you see the question and you're like, oh, obviously I'd rather have the test suite. And then the next question comes up and it's working on an application and you lose everything. Would you rather have the test suite or the code? And it's like, oh yeah, I'd actually much rather have the code in that situation. So I was trying to think of like why. And I was trying to think of like, have there been libraries I've worked on where I'd rather have the code? And have there been, applications I've worked on where I'd rather have the test suite.
It's a good way to think about
it. Yeah, like really push myself to the edges there. And like, yeah, design, man. Design is like the thing that does it. Like if I was working on like a CLI application, I'd actually think I'd be okay with the test suite. Mm-hmm. Like just, I don't know, like can you call like something like cat or grep?
Right.
But that's like kind of a bash library.
It's an app.
But like even things like, I don't know, like Ember CLI. Like Ember CLI had a really good test suite.
Yeah.
Like, so
yeah,
there are CLI apps that are actually apps.
Yep.
And then I was also thinking like, well, what about like something like jQuery like calendar widget? Like that's a library. I think I'd rather have the code.
Because it's going to be gnarly.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of pop-ups there's going to be tons of...
That's true. Something with more UI. A library that has more UI.
There's going to be all these
apps that have less UI is basically what you're saying.
Yeah. CLI exactly. Has less UI. So it's like, design UI. That's like the thing. Yeah. And it's just like...
Harder to test for...
That's a question he's asking. He's just using library and application code as a proxy for a lot of UI and no UI. Just think of like when a designer designs something, we don't write tests for that, but obviously it's tested. We share it with the designer and you get feedback.
Oh, you get, it's some of the most robust feedback you get. I mean, when we were working on Headless UI with Steven Adam, like every screen, every size was looked at and you could care less how we were writing a remark plugin, you know, our implementation of the code.
Well, those aren't tested. So.
Well, right.
No, but I guess like the output the of code, the app is tested.
The code is not mattered as much. Doesn't matter as much. And then I was thinking too, like times where I'd rather have library code than library test would be really hard implementation of something. So some difficult thing.
Maybe
the React virtual DOM implementation is hard from like a CS perspective or some hard algorithm, some 3JS renderer. And I would not want to rewrite that even if the test suite was really good because it's just a lot of work. Yeah. And a lot of the apps that we work on, it's figuring out what the business logic should be and the behavior. And then the building it, obviously it takes time, but it's actually harder. The harder part is figuring out like the specifications, which is like why that's valuable. But there are some obviously computer projects where like, you know, the self-driving car mind, like that's probably a lot of code that you wouldn't want to get rid of, even if you had a good test suite.
You know, it's interesting, like with those sort of test suites, they might not capture the requirements of the library. So like, you and I could write like a virtual DOM thing, but it might be really, really slow because we might just use like some generic tree diffing algorithm where I know that React has spent a lot of time like creating a bunch of like heuristics and shortcuts.
Right.
So it's fast.
Right.
So we might pass the test suite,
right,
but every update might take, you know, 200 milliseconds.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting. What
it depends.
What does a test suite capture?
Yeah.
And then is that thing that is that valuable to you? And so like the test suite doesn't capture the UI or the design, I guess. See, I don't like saying like doesn't capture the UI because I think like, oh, my Cypress tests are UI tests, but it's more than that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could totally write a passing Cypress test that had like loaded no CSS.
Right. Right.
And that app would be broken,
right,
but all the tests would be passed.
Right. 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 So yeah. Yeah, like there's a lot of software that I'd rather have like Mac OS. I have to imagine there's a lot of untested behavior in like Mac OS.
Yeah.
And it's grown up over decades or whatever. Like they can never get rid of that, right? I mean, they can never rewrite that, right? There has to be some software like that that's just like, you know, Linux or whatever. Like it's just like a lot. And you're never going to be able to... You're going to always have to rely on the fact that there's like unspecified behavior that people rely on because it's gotten to that point.
Yeah. I wonder if there's like an airplane joke here. Like, would you rather get on an airplane that was like implemented from the test suite or they had the source code?
I don't know.
Something like that.
See, I'd rather have the airplane, the source code.
The source code because there's years and years of knowledge.
That's the real test is like the usage of it. Right. I mean, the tests are trying to capture people's usage of it. But if you have that's why people say things are battle tested, because you'd rather have software that's battle tested than something that's well tested in a laboratory, because where the rubber meets the road is in the real world.
Yep.
So tests are about like confidence and behavior, I guess. So, you know, it's kind of a question about if you could start from scratch with one or the other, which one would you be more confident you get the right behavior and faster? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting too. A lot of times we don't.
Tailwind would be like something I would want the test suite because, you know, I'm guessing it's like covering a lot of, you could imagine re-implementing Tailwind like in a variety of ways. Kind of like you said, you could do a virtual DOM, you know, but the test suite is going to probably capture a lot of like the weird behavior.
When we write tests, we don't write tests for the purpose of some evil genius stealing it.
Yeah.
And us being able to recreate it. Oftentimes we write tests for like, I want to codify like the behavior here. So like if I change something somewhere, I'll get feedback if I break this.
Yeah. I want a bot to be able to deploy my website.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or upgrade it.
That seems different. Like if I knew I was writing tests to recreate.
If I knew you're going to have to lose one or the other. Yeah.
I might write my tests differently. I mean, in theory, I shouldn't, but it might change how I write the test. So anyway.
Yeah.
It's a good question.
It is a good question. Yeah. That's a fun one. What else do we have on our list? Anything? We have unstable avoid this fallback. Just, I know I've been tweeting about this, but in case anyone is out there listening who hasn't come across this yet, I've been making YouTube videos on suspense and talking about it on Twitter because it's been fun. React 18 is in release candidate version, so suspense will be, I guess, part of that. I don't know if suspense has already been part of 17. Has it?
Yeah, it is, but I think there's some behavior stuff.
Some behavior stuff changing with effects. Now, data fetching for suspense, which is my interest in it, is not going to be ready when 18 comes out, but there's libraries like SWR that use it, and so it's just like kind of, you can use it, and if you don't run into bugs, it's fine as far as I can tell.
I think there's like some important but edge case things that don't work, like your refetching.
Yeah.
What is your suspense state?
But it seems to work well enough that that you can play around with it. So one thing that I ran into pretty quickly after working with suspense is this idea that like you sometimes want to change your suspense boundaries at runtime. So specifically when you first load your app, you want something like a splash screen to render. And it would be nice if you use suspense for that because depending on what route you're on, you might have lots of components in your tree that are fetching data. But you don't want to come up with the way. I mean, that's what suspense is for. It lets you tell parents we're not ready yet. So ideally, you have a root suspense boundary that's like, if I'm suspending, then render a splash screen. And that way, the first time the app renders, boom, you're good to go. And then all those components rendering from cache so that they won't hit that suspense boundary again. But if you navigate to a new route after you've loaded, it will go back up there and that will render. So you don't want the splash screen to show every time a component fetches data in your app. So what you do is you add a suspense boundary down in the tree further down, let's say around a message. If you were doing like messages or something, you're clicking on it. So you just wrap the detail pane with a suspense boundary. You select a new message and the detail pane shows a spinner and that works. But now when you refresh on a message, you have two boundaries. So you have the outer one, which you want to use on the first render, and then you have the nested ones, which you want for more granular loading UI. And so when you first load the app, if any of the outer data fetching components finish, the splash screen goes away. But if the message is still loading, you'll see like a second loading spinner. So now you'll have like this spinning waterfall, like a spinner waterfall. So you pretty quickly run into this situation where you want to use suspense for all these things, which means you need to change your boundaries as the user moves through the application lifecycle. So on initial render or once they start navigating. And so you can do this because you can rely on the fact that effects only run once a subtree of components has finished suspending. And that's how you can track whether or not the application has done an initial render yet. That's not a fallback UI. And then you know to add new suspense boundaries just using conditional logic in the JSX lower down the tree. So I did that. I extracted to a component called like suspense after initial render. And it makes it nice for you to be able to add suspense boundaries in your JSX that only take effect after the initial render. Now there's this prop on Suspense called Unstable Avoid This Fallback, which is a great name. Unstable prefix means it might go away, but avoid this fallback is basically exactly what I'm saying. So like on the first render, you want to avoid using this boundary. So you want it to bubble up to the parent boundary, basically. So if this existed, you could say avoid this fallback. And then I don't know if it takes a prop, probably like a Boolean, right?
Yeah.
And you would just say first, you would still need some state, I guess, for first render. So you'd say avoid this if it's the initial render.
I thought avoid this callback was avoid this fallback was
only render. For the first render.
Yeah, I thought it was.
Maybe it does that.
Okay.
I thought it was. You would think it'd be a Boolean, right?
I think it is a Boolean.
But you would think it would be like if you flipped the Boolean to true, it would be as if the suspense boundary doesn't exist. So you don't have to render the content twice.
Right, because you're saying it's like more declarative than like an imperative. Exactly. Like, do this only once.
Exactly.
I don't know. I thought it took care of the render logic.
Do this only once just to avoid you having to do like...
After initial render.
Yeah, like dashboard else suspense dashboard.
It's like skip this boundary.
Yeah, exactly.
On initial load.
Yeah, or... I don't know.
By the way, this situation, it is like you did a good job describing it, but it is hard to describe this UI. Like, it's just hard to describe.
Yeah, I think I think my video next week is going to be about it. And I think it comes up in most apps. Like,
comes up in every app.
Yeah.
I mean, every app we've worked on.
Yeah, most apps, when you load it, there's an initial loader and then there's more granular loading for doing things. So once you start using suspense everywhere, you're going to go up the tree to the boundaries. And so that's where you run into this. So, if you're interested or you've been, someone responded to one of my tweets that was like, we've been using suspense for a year. It's good at these things. It's annoying over here. I'd love to hear more stories like that because I haven't been doing that, like, especially in production. And this problem felt very common to me. Like, it felt like something that everyone's going to run into. So I'd be curious how people are solving this if they're running into this and solving it. So, but yeah, pretty cool stuff. I'm excited for it. I'm excited for, like, you know, we talked about using use router in Next and how that should suspend because if you're on a dynamic route in Next, the first render, you don't know the thing. So if you, this is where all this defensive code, this has come up in our consulting projects. Router.isReady is not true, so you have to wait, or you put a guard at the root of your app, you render a spinner. Wouldn't it be nice if your page components could just say, use router equals router, router.query this, use SWR, use, you know, messages / query.messageid, and you're not thinking about it. And the whole thing suspends until that's ready.
It's exactly the stuff we were talking about last week. By the way, I think my prediction would be we would get that once suspense comes more like mainstream.
Yeah.
But what we were talking about last week were like, from the concept of a component, if the data isn't ready, the component, like, you just don't go to the next line. The component, like, the component isn't ready.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel the same way about router. If I'm doing use router and the router is not ready, I don't even want to go on to the next line.
Yeah, I don't want that component to render itself even in a loading state because it's literally just waiting for the router to be ready. So it's exactly like what we talked about last time.
Yep.
Yeah. Cool. It feels like that. And I said that on Twitter and Brandon, the guy who does Blitz, he said, yeah, I would agree. And has helped write a framework on top of Next. So I think he's had more experience with this. So that was interesting to me. I think that'd be cool. What else we got here?
I think this will be short, but had an application, wasn't writing tests because the setup was really difficult. Hasura application using a bunch of Hasura APIs. And so, like, me testing that, like, someone's login was invalid. It was, like, pretty hard to, like, set that up. My options were basically just, like, mock a bunch of stuff, which was just brittle because I was also changing a bunch of stuff. So I finally got around to, like, setting up tests. It's just like, oh my, once you have, like, a reproducible test environment, and you can say, like, I should get this error when I log in with an invalid account. I should get this screen when I log in with a valid. Oh, you wish you had
it earlier.
You're just like, I can't believe I went
I know.
4 months I without know. Any
Remember
of this.
Remember when I got all my tests wired up for Fitness Challenge? I was saying exactly the same thing. I was telling you this. I was like, I should have never gone past the first screen without writing a test for it. And you're like, no, in the beginning, it's good to move fast. I was like, dude, it's so bad, though. Like, and it's so much better when you have that stuff because...
Well, this app that I was working on, it was hard to set up because I needed a Sur instance running with a Sur OS. So like, do I want to go on to the dashboard screen or do I want to spend my weekend just like setting all this stuff up? And that so like, sense. There is like trade-off there, but man, like when you get the test, it's just, how did I live without this? I mean, that's a sign that like we're going way too far without writing tests.
No, it would be nice to, I haven't messed around, you know, we've been just doing the Hasura stuff because it's like basically solved our problems for the back end as far as the side projects we're going are concerned, and focusing instead on like frame of motion, React Suspense, all the front end stuff. But it'd be nice to try Supabase or Planet Scale and see if they have any testing story, what their testing story is for local development. Firebase, I haven't done the emulator yet, but just to see how if those have evolved at all.
Yeah, I mean, I want to use Hasura. Like, I want that Hasura gets me right to the line that I want to be at, which is GraphQL endpoints. Where I know that Supabase has tweeted that they're working on it, or maybe they're done with
GraphQL
it.
GraphQL API.
But like when I used Supabase, it was nothing wrong with it. It was a ORM API.
Got you. So you're writing.
And then like Planet Scales.
Are you writing like endpoints in your next app?
No. It's like a client-side ORM. Gotcha. So you're just saying like, you know, users.all..
It'd be like using Firebase on the client.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I like the line that Hasura gets us to. It's just that when you rely on all these services, testing is really hard.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to like get this set up, and it's great now that I have it. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But
did you see that article I shared about building the app on the bus or whatever? Maybe I didn't put that in Slack. I just put it on my work journal, I think. But the guy built it was on Hacker News. He built like an app that lowered his heating bill.
Oh yeah, you did share that.
Yeah.
It was a remix.
Yeah, remix. Yeah. And I think it was Supabase and Prisma, I think. And then Fly.io for the database, which you can just say, like, I want a Postgres database. Give me a URL. Boom, done.
That seems a lot like Supabase.
Maybe it wasn't.
I think I read that. I don't remember him mentioning Supabase. Maybe, whatever.
Maybe he wasn't. But yeah. So... and then he did like a scraper service to scrape the data from the website. But point being, like, is his tension between server, we talked about this before, your services and like the full stack integrated monolith or whatever. Because if you start a new Rails or Laravel app, you have the testing story out of the box. But the whole point of his article was like web development, modern web development, what it calls it, is great today. I couldn't have, there's a huge learning curve with all this stuff, but I couldn't have done this even like 3 or 4 years ago because like a service to scrape, a hosted database really easily that I can put my stuff in. It's all free. You know, Remix was hosted. I don't forget how he hosted it, but he said he wrote on like a bus. It was pretty impressive, okay. You know? So that was interesting. I think that's maybe there's some tension there between the services letting you move fast and then being hard to test and develop in a coherent, as a coherent way. You have to be more disciplined about it, you know?
Yeah. I will say, I think the services that I've used, testing isn't a big selling point when you're evaluating these services unless you've been burnt before. Right. And so I don't think it's as important. Just like
for you or
no. I think
people who are, you're saying like you don't see it as a feature, basically.
Well, you know, it's funny because I do think it's a feature. And like, I know that like, there's a like Steph tweet that we've talked about before who said, he says when he's evaluating services, like testing is like a thing that would make him like just not use a service or something like that.
Yeah.
Or, not have a service catch on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would be for me. But when I remember when I tried Supabase and Hasura, it was like, holy crap, I'm just like writing an ORM. I'm writing ORM code with like nothing behind it. Like
yeah.
No models,
yeah.
No database, no Postgres. Like they handle all that. And it's mind blowing.
Totally.
So,
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, we get it. You're on the train. You're aboard the train.
Dude, the testing stuff's really important.
It's really important. I know.
I guess the other side of it is like you can, Hasura doesn't like pitch JavaScript based testing, but you can. I mean, I was able to get it set up. It was brutal.
Yeah.
But I was able to get it
set up. Follow their guides to get it running locally, you're saying.
You run it locally and I have it so it resets and then, after every test run and you get like a empty database and
it's not bad.
It's I feel good.
I mean, that is good because now you don't have to. Yeah, it's nice not to have to write mocks.
Yeah,
you don't have to write
mocks. And the reason that like drove this was like some of the so Hasura has like the APIs that are like, you know, insert one, and that's easy to mock.
Yeah,
or like conceptually, it's easy to mock. But then there's others that are like just like a bunch of aggregate functions, and those are that's where it gets like okay, my mocks are like actually. Real code, and then now I'm just testing mocks.
Right.
And I don't even trust myself to do this right. So
right. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. The jury's still out.
Yeah.
So I have this package for uploading files to S3 for Next.js.
Mm-hmm. I use it.
Yeah, you used it. So I bundle the AWS SDK in that that package has a dependency on the AWS SDK, and mm-hmm. the AWS SDK handles all the I didn't reinvent any of the AWS code. I just use the SDK, and I you know my library is more glue code between the AWS SDK and Next and React. That's mm-hmm. And then I just rely on those things to do the heavy lifting. AWS SDK, there's a version 3 and a version 4. I think a version 2 and a version 3. This is how much I know about the AWS SDK. Let's say version 2 and a version 3.
Uh-huh.
And I think version 2 is widely used. Most apps are using it. Some people have asked, can we use version 3? And but part of the problem here is like I don't understand why they want version 3.
I was going to say, none of the APIs are exposed through your API, right?
Yeah, I think there might be some stuff maybe with how their AWS is set up, or maybe I'm depending on version 2, but they have a actual like dependency in their root app that's depending on version 3, and there might be some like resolution stuff because you're just importing from, you know, AWS SDK. Regardless of the reasoning there, because I'm still figuring this out, I was thinking like, how could I make that a configuration option?
Wouldn't it be a peer dependency? You bring your own,
like you bring your own, and then you
version detect in the code that you're using whether the supplied version is 2 or 3. It's like what we do in Rails.
Yeah, but Rails has like so in JavaScript, like the imports are static. So like I need to like import the AWS code and like new S3.
Right.
And so if I don't know where I'm importing it from, that's like a problem. So I was thinking like
it's like a different import path.
Yeah, and the APIs change. I mean, it's a new version.
If it's the same object, but you're getting it from a different package, you could do like feature detection on the import. Like if it was import AWS from AWS, and AWS could be either version 2 or 3, you could say like if you know, AWS.version or whatever.
The thing is like I get what you're saying. Like you're always importing the same module.
Yeah.
But the thing is like, it's a version change. Like there's no contract that all the modules are going to be the same between. Yeah. So I was thinking like they could like, when they invoke my library, they could pass in an AWS.
Yeah.
And then I could like, it's a bit adapter pattern it.
Right.
But man, like think about it. Like you're like a new user and you're setting this up. And you're like installing AWS as a peer dependency.
Well, if you're new, I don't think you'd have to. I think there's a way you can do it. Wait, we've definitely run into this where you can either bring your own or we supply it if you don't have it. There's an Ember thing that we did.
Like this. Faker, maybe?
Yeah.
With Mirage?
Yeah, something like that.
Is why I wanted to talk about
this.
Because
yeah, yeah.
But how? Like I have code that, like, it's glue code for AWS, so I'm importing all the AWS modules.
But you're importing them from the resolution, like the graph that's on the user's machine. Like, your import path is just pointing to whatever node resolves it to be, right?
Yeah.
Which is on the user's machine at the time that they're running your code. So, yeah. So that could point to different things. I think it's something like peer dependencies, or we did, you know. Yeah, there was some Ember. I'm trying to remember. For some reason, I'm having this feeling like it was something we worked on with Ed, which maybe makes me think it might have been the animation stuff.
Okay.
But it might have also just been him helping out with Mirage and, like, you need a pretender or faker. Yeah, maybe it was faker. Maybe it was add. Yeah.
Oh, it might have been pretender. Like, detect if it's
different
there.
Version. Or add packages to projects. Remember that API from Ember CLI? When you install a package, it, like, adds it in that.
It's like a better, it's like a quote, better peer dependency because you guarantee that it gets in.
Yeah. And then maybe that was it. You just add it. And that way, if the user wants more control, like, it's a dependency they manage, but new users don't really have to understand it.
But the thing is.
But that seems weird.
How do I have a file that's going to import S3 from AWS. That could change between version 3 and version 4, version 4 and version 5.
Well, your package has a dependency on AWS version 3. So the dependency says it can only work with 3.
Yeah, and people have been asking, like, oh, I think it's 2, and they want 3.
So you'd, yeah, so.
I would remove that dependency.
Or you'd say 3 or 4, and then you'd have to feature detect to know which version you're on.
But I feel like at that point, it's like, the imports happen before the feature detection. Like, feature detection,
well, again,
is like runtime.
It matters. What matters is, are the import paths changing? You know, if you imported server from Mirage.js, that would be there in, let's say, both major versions. And then you just use feature detection to see if, like, handle is there. If server.handle, okay, we're in version 2. Otherwise, we're in version 1. So that would be fine. If the import path changes, then you need to do some sort of dynamic.
Well, that's another thing. I was thinking of dynamic import.
Yeah, that would make it very easy if it all only had to run on the server or at server time.
It does run
SSG time.
It does run on the client,
okay.
But it doesn't run during render. It's only when they actually, like, select the file and start uploading.
Right.
So
you could do a dynamic.
So I could do dynamic import there.
Like, import a component or something that imports. You could import a different component based. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. I'd have to see, like, the use case, but there's some adapter pattern thing here.
I know, but the classic adapter pattern is going to be, like, you tell me the AWS you want, and then at runtime I can do, like, feature detection.
Yeah, so I think that's where, like, the dependency injection thing is, makes more sense.
Yeah, exactly, because I don't want to do that because I feel like it's too much of a burden on new users.
Yeah, sure.
To be, like...
But you can have you should be able to have a default injection. Like, if you don't supply it, you get a default.
Well, if you supply null... Then I can rely on the default, but then at that point, I have an import in my code somewhere, and that.
Well, you have one file that's AWS V2, it imports the things according to V2 API. At one point, you have the V3, and then depending on.
But I have a component that needs.
Maybe it has a dev dependency on both on whatever the default is. I'd have to see it. This is getting technical.
Okay.
I think there's a way to do it where you have two files, one that expects AWS V2 to be in your module graph, one that expects V3. They don't both run. Like, only one of them runs depending on what you choose.
Wait, that's actually a thing I could do. Like, you import S3, use S3 upload from next S3 upload. I could just provide two different imports. I could just say you import use S3 upload from...
Yeah.
Next S3 upload slash V2 slash V3.
Yeah.
It feels like, okay. And then those could, like, there'd be like a,
you could have a default, like how in Mirage, you can, like, hand it your own pretender instance. But if you don't, we just new it up ourselves.
One of the reasons this is so tricky is that in Ruby, I can just do all runtime importing, all runtime sniffing.
Yeah, it was running on the server. Yeah.
Well, not even if it was running on the client. It's just that
there's no
JavaScript modules imports are like static.
Yeah, I know, but that's because they run on the client. Like you don't want to, you can't ship the entire node module directly.
I see.
Yeah, and resolve different things.
Yeah.
But I think you care about what ends up in the bundle. You don't want two versions of AWS to go to your clients.
Right. Exactly.
For all those reasons, yeah.
Exactly. You don't want two versions to go, and then I just sniff out the one, like you pass V4 as like a config option.
Right.
And it's like, well, I just downloaded 5 megabytes of
V3. Right, exactly.
I feel like the dynamic programming stuff like this in JavaScript is really hard.
Yeah.
And like when I do it in other languages, I don't even have to think about it. And then JavaScript, it's like, what do I do? And then anytime, I don't know about
it. I think you have way more experience with me than me doing it in other languages. But yeah, I've run into those problems too. And it's tricky.
And then usually if I like ever find myself in a spot where I'm doing like dynamic import, like import parens, some URL or and then like awaiting it, it just for some reason always feels like code smell.
Oh, totally. I've never done that.
Every time it happens, I'm like, how do I get away from this? Why am I doing it? Like, you better have a really, really good reason.
I mean, I think Next is under the hood, right? That's how Next does the code splitting on per route. So I think that our code is doing that. It's just I've never done it. I've seen it before. So it's the only official way to use Suspense right now is with lazy import. React.lazy. I guess that was gross. With React.lazy. Is React.lazy the same as dynamic import? I don't know.
Yeah, it might be because it's like fetching a component from.
I think it is a dynamic import.
That for some reason, though, that seems more like, this is going to sound stupid, but that seems more like a React API that's like blessed.
No, totally. We haven't done a lot of like node hacking where we're using dynamic require and like if statements and stuff. It's just because we're conditioned by like the browser world and the ES6 static stuff that you know what I'm saying? But in Node, you can do dynamic requires.
Of course. In Node, Node would be super easy. I could do, you know, if the user has like a config file and they want V3.
Yeah.
I mean, Node, I could detect the user's package JSON.
Yeah. You can do a lot of things.
Yeah. And just that's say, probably they want what V3.
We did. And then we set, I think, see, it's coming back to me. There was something like that where you detect what they have. If they, what was it? Was it Mirage or was it like Ember Animated? You detect the version of the thing in their package and then you like either include that one or you set like an environment variable of what version it is. So that when the client code runs, they know if we're on Pretender 2 or if they had jQuery or something like that.
I think it might be Mirage. It's coming back to me. It might be
Mirage and Pretender.
Sorry, we're like rehashing old time. Yeah, I didn't mean to go down this road.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's
the first week of the year. All right? We don't have that much to talk about. but no, that would be interesting. We should take a look together and then I can maybe ask some folks who work on that because maybe like Adam's run into that.
Yeah.
So, you know? With the version, they've had some major version bumps lately, so maybe they do some feature detection or version detection and have dealt with NPM. You know, you would think, man, we were doing Ember stuff 4 or 5 years ago on this, and you'd think it'd be, I don't know if it's any better. I don't know if the peer dependency thing ever worked out or if anyone uses that. People are still complaining about CommonJS modules versus ES6 modules on Twitter, so... I mean,
dude,
I don't deal with it as much as I used to because I don't do as much library code as I used to in Ember world, you know, but I have a feeling it's all still kind of a mess.
Yeah. By the way, just on this, I just ran into this for the first time where I'm using a node package that's marked as a type module in Node. And so I have to make all my files MJS files.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And it's just like... I was submitting
a PR. It removes the type module.
But the person that there's a whole suite of these modules, and they're converting them all, so they're very like on board. And I get it. Okay. Like, why do you want to maintain?
Oh, the roll up stuff.
A build tool.
Oh yeah, if you don't have
packages that like takes you're authoring in ES6.
Dude, no, that's like, amazing. If that's true, as an author, I can understand that.
Yeah,
you just distribute
and you've got ES like module. A million modules.
Yeah.
And like, why would you want to? It's
is
like
it Cinder.
No. It's a Uniist, AST, MDX stuff, and so they have a ton of just like
Yeah, little
a modules. Ton of AST modules.
Yeah.
And yeah, I get it. Like, why do they want to maintain
yeah
two different builds? So like just the fact
but that, why doesn't your build tool yeah, it's just weird. Because you're importing it in Node, that's why.
I'm importing it's running in Node.
Nextconfig or something like that. Yeah.
Which runs in Node.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
yeah.
I'm like thank God Next just says, oh well if you need modules, you can change you can just rename the file to nextconfig.mjs and it all just works, you know, I have to rename everything downstream.
Right.
But man, it's like, it kind of makes you think like, why can't Node just like ditch this common JS
thing? No, I know. But then you see the people who are like Node hackers and I've been doing it for a long time. And I've done plenty of Node stuff, but not like really like.
Well, I guess.
And they're like, oh, common JS is like what was made for Node is way better. Yeah. It's like async. It's or it's,
you know, dynamic require.
Dynamic require. It's built in. It's easier. You can put it in a variable. All this kind of thing.
Dude, taking this.
The constraints of the static ES6. And we talked about this a million times.
Dude, it's the same thing I'm facing with the AWS thing. Yeah. It's like if Node adopted that, I wouldn't be able to. How would I do this?
Right.
It would be a lot harder.
Right.
So on that front.
They're different environments. Node and the browser are different environments. They happen to use the same programming language, but they face different constraints. And the module systems are, it's just kind of still feels like a mess. I don't know. I mean, most of my work, I don't have to think about it because most of the module, there was one that I used recently that was annoying, but yeah.
No, this really helped me understand why Node doesn't want to just adopt the module syntax because they don't need all the static
resolution. They'd be giving up a lot of
they want to do runtime. They want to do runtime resolution. Yeah. All the stuff that I was saying is so great about Ruby. They want to, it's just, you don't have to think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
And the browser doesn't want to do that. So there's this.
Exactly. If you're a Ruby developer and I told you now you have to know your modules ahead of time, you can't do dynamic, you'd be like, why? Why would I give that up?
Yeah. And so there's
it makes sense to have it in the browser because it gives you benefits.
Right. And then there's a tension. The tension is that like when I write Next apps, I'm not thinking about, oh, this is running in Node and this is running in the browser.
But
I'm
thinking, the reality is.
It is.
It is.
And I had to confront that. Yeah. But
well, that's why a lot of times we're like,
I look at it as I'm just writing JavaScript.
Yeah, I know.
Which is
sometimes the right way and sometimes can get used to. Yeah. Well, that's why a lot of times we just like, can we just do this client side? If I'm doing dynamic data, I mean, how often do you need, SSG is cool on my website. Like the journal is like pre-rendered and it's really fast. That's nice. But if I'm making like a user-specific data application, it would be nice. Again, we've talked about this too, where you could just put the app in CSR, client-side rendering mode. Let's just turn off SSR.
SSG, SSR.
Yep. I guess they argued they want you to fall into like Pit of Success fast by default. And if you like, spread the cost out of SSR from the beginning of the thing, you're going to be like, it's going to be a lot better than trying to like retrofit it. So,
and also too, like it's, our experience has largely been positive.
I know it has, but there's a lot there when you are working on a dynamic page and a form submission, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, like you reload it or it's something weird. The developer is like thinking it's like writing two apps sometimes.
You think you're writing one app. You're really writing two. You import what's like
you add a route. There's two different ways to get there. Client side navigation or server or initial render, which is running on the server. There's two different code paths, but you are like coding it as if it were just one feature. You know, it's
here's my proposal. We split JavaScript into two languages. So I never think that I'm writing JavaScript. I'm always just fully aware.
I guess that's what
MJS is.
Yeah. I guess if I had to go all one or all the other, I'd rather just do an SPA because I like those better. But I don't know if those are... I don't know, without server rendering, a lot of people complain about them. They've never bothered me as much as they bother other people.
They didn't bother me when I was writing them, but I feel like all the people that would like... The back end developers that would like stab the front end developers and then twist the knife. That was like, oh, and you have to like your SPA, and that's like the knife twist, right? It's like the SPA is like you have to download all the JavaScript to render.
I feel like
Next was like that someone stabbing you and like just bounces off a plate of body armor. Yeah. And you look, you're like, oh, body armor provided by Next.js.
That's good. You're right. No one writes SPAs anymore. You can't even say that you do that.
Yeah,
you're like SPA developer. Like, what? That's funny, man. No, I've had good experience. Obviously, Next is like my go-to these days. It has a lot of cool server-side features I use. So, but there are times where you're doing dynamic user-specific data stuff and you really want to just think about it. Like my admin page where I actually create my work journal entries, I just do client-side. I do it in effect so I don't have to think about it. I don't even render it until I know you're on the client because I know I'm going to do auth on the client through Firebase. And I don't want to think about the server stuff at all. So,
yep,
kind of interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
two languages.
Yeah, seems like the right way to solve this problem. That was a fun discussion, though. Cool. Well, first week of the new year. Hoping to do a lot with the studio right here. We're in the studio, which is why it's so reverby. We're not even unpacked. We're getting some cube shelf here tomorrow. We're gonna put away all these boxes. Going to get some sound treatment, maybe paint an accent wall. Hopefully have two little leather chairs over there with a little table for our podcast setup. And hopefully encourage us to make some more stuff. And we're going to be doing some consulting here soon in the next month or two. So we'll have some more stuff to talk about from that as well. In the meantime, we're going to be working on one YouTube video a week. That is our little pledge that we've made to ourselves. So we'll link to our YouTube channels in the podcast so you can keep your eye out for those. And otherwise, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.
Bye.